You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Ondaatje's latest novel, The Cat's Table, tells the story of Michael, an 11-year-old boy who's traveling alone from Colombo, the capital of what is now Sri Lanka, to London aboard a luxury liner called the Arense. He is seated in the dining room at the cat's table, the one furthest from the captain's table, where he meets two other boys his age who become his partners in crime and fellow adventurers during the journey. This, his latest, is published by Knopf. It's been receiving rave reviews, and I guess we shouldn't be surprised because Mr. Ondaatje won the Booker Prize for an earlier novel called The English Patient. I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
What kind of life is Michael leaving in Colombo?
A pretty feral life, I think. You know, he's 11 years old. He was at a school in Colombo that was almost too dangerous, but you know, he was always being punished and beaten by teachers and so forth.
Now, is Colombo the capital of Ceylon at this point?
Yes.
Now Sri Lanka?
Yes, it is.
So, and he is, why is he being sent to England?
Well, I think there was a sort of tradition in Sri Lanka that, you know, at the age of 11 or so, if you could afford it, you sent your kids to England to go to school, and they went to a good school, and they hopefully went to Oxford or Cambridge and got a blue in rowing or something meaningless. And then they came back, and they became, you know, part of the family law firm or the doctor's firm or something like that.
And the leaders of the country.
That's right. But, you know, I think what happened in terms of my generation was mine was the first one that went away and never really came back.
Is he nervous about what awaits him? The new life that he'll be having in England?
He's nervous about what's going to happen. I mean, in a way, he's sort of blocked off the future, in a way. He's still kind of dealing with the past, and he's dealing with life on a ship. He's not really, he has no idea what's going to happen to him in England. You know, he hasn't got any plan. He's been sent off on the ship without any kind of parental guidance, and then there are no parents with him. So he's utterly free and, you know, is having a wonderful time as a result.
Although there is a woman who, at least in theory, is supposed to be watching him, Flavia Prinz, and then he also has a cousin on board, but pretty much he is on his own. And he's at the cat's table. Where does that term come from?
It's actually it's a phrase I heard from a German publisher a few years ago, and it really is the table. If you're at some banquet and you're by the bathroom or the kitchen, that's the cat's table where, you know, you hear the noise from the kitchen, people yelling back there. So it's the least significant, least privileged place. And I just picked up that idea, and it was very useful. It suddenly gave the book a kind of focus that all these five or six or seven people who the boy watches and gets involved with on the ship, they're all in this one table. So that was a handy thing.
Is he sent there with, there were two other boys around his age, because he is so young? They don't want to mix him in with the more important adults?
Yeah, I think, you know, in fact, the cast table literally means, I think, originally the children's table or the something like that. So he tends to kind of, you know, be put where all the insignificants are. And as a result, you know, he begins to love these people and the fact that they're really quite anarchic as well.
They're also adults at this table.
Right.
Now, Michael knows one of the boys, Cassius, from school, although they weren't friends there. But Cassius is notorious. He was expelled once for locking someone in a bathroom.
Well, I mean, Cassius was one of those wonderful characters in the book who, the minute I gave him the name Cassius, he became, you know, even more dangerous and anarchic and an iconoclast in every way. So, I mean, he had locked a teacher in the bathroom and kind of cemented the lock so he couldn't get out for about 3 or 4 hours, and he was expelled. And so, and on the ship, he kind of causes more and more chaos with the narrator, Michael.
Was it common for 11-year-old children to travel alone for weeks at a time like that?
I think it probably was. I mean, it's really quite shocking when you think about it today. You know, you wouldn't put your kid on a bus, you know, to go too far downtown sometimes. But, you know, I mean, my parents went, did that kind of trip, and I'd met many, many people actually since writing the book who took ship journeys. I mean, that was a great tradition of people coming from the East to England and so forth. And a lot of those kids went alone, but more often with their parents.
I went to England from New York on a ship in the days when you did that sort of thing, and it was a lot of fun. But it was very much a class-conscious situation. I think there were three classes on the ship, and it was only when we hit the mid-Atlantic and most of the people were in their rooms groaning from seasickness that they allowed us, the rest of us, the people with good sea legs, to mingle with each other.
Yeah, there was that. I mean, suddenly the boys are in tourist class for sure, and then the woman, Mrs. Prince, who was supposed to look after him, is in first class. So these boys kind of, you know, sneak up to first class at dawn before anyone is awake, and then try and steal all the good breakfast there and so forth.
Now, you share the same name as the book's narrator, and some reviewers have called this a combination memoir novel. Do you admit to that?
Well, I think it's very much a fiction. I mean, I did take such a trip when I was 11, and my name is Michael. So, but I mean, I remembered nothing of the trip, and this was a strange thing. So I kind of really had to go back and picked up this kind of blocked part of my past and try and invent a story out of it. And it became a kind of adventure book more than a memoir for me. You know, it wasn't. By using elements of myself, it kind of made the book in some ways more intimate to the reader, I think. And in a way, by calling him Michael, I was able to distance myself, in fact, from him, because he had to be someone different now.
Although he's a well-known writer who's looking back on this trip. Mm-hmm. He records, the young boy records everything in a school exam booklet. I guess that's what a possible future novelist might be doing. Did you do that sort of thing?
No, I didn't. But, you know, I just wanted to give him a literary life early on in some kind of minor way, just the way Cassius, the other boy, who's really quite bad and who eventually becomes a painter, you know, that's a scene where he kind of sees this nude mural and he kind of studies it for hours in the hold of the ship.
Do you write down bits of overheard conversation now, descriptions of people that you come across?
No, maybe I should.
We mentioned, is it Flavia? Flavia, how do you...
Flavia Prince.
She's serving as his guardian during the trip, although they rarely see each other. But they do engage in some exchange of gossip.
Yes, well, there's a prisoner on board, and the boy has seen, with the other two boys, has seen the prisoner being given a walk every night at midnight. And so when he meets his aunt, he kind of talks to her, and she mentions that there's a prisoner, but it's quite safe. And then he tells her that, in fact, you know, he's actually seen the prisoner. And so this upsets the aunt, who feels she knows much more than he does. So there's a little battle going on all the way through the book between these two people. And she becomes, for me in the book, a kind of Lady Bracknell kind of figure, you know, very superior. She's very good at cards, and she's kind of cutting a swath through all the card players on the ship.
There's also a distant cousin of Michael's on board, Emily. She's 17. What's she doing going to England?
She's going to finish her schooling there. Spend the last 2 years doing a school.
Would he view her as an adult at 17?
She's on the verge of becoming an adult. You know, she's older than him, and yet he has known her in the past, and so he, you know, learns a lot of things from her, you know, about whether he's right or wrong about certain issues. And she becomes a very important person for the rest of his life, actually.
Would you describe this as a kind of a coming of age? He's a little young to be engaged in that, but he learns an awful lot from the people that he's forced to get to know. Mr. Marzappa, one of the adults at the table, a piano player who says he's hit the skids.
Well, I think 11-year-olds or children of that age learn a great deal subconsciously from people. You know, they learn where power lies, for instance. They can recognize who has the power in a room or in a conversation. And in a way, the book is about an education of Michael. You know, at the end they say, well, now it's time to go to school. But in fact, he's been to school. He's been to school in a very real world. And he meets Mr. Laschetti was a possible spy from Whitehall and so forth. So he meets this great range of people. And he's not really conscious of learning these things. In a way, that's why there's another voice in the book of Michael when he's an older person as a writer, kind of looking back and recognizing now all the things that have fallen now into a pattern.
He also, the smell of burning hemp leads him to a man named Mr. Fonseca. Why would he be attracted to the smell of burning hemp?
Well, as a boy in Sri Lanka, one of the essential smells is burning hemp, which is...
That's different than marijuana, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yes.
Although, marijuana comes from
I know.
The hemp plant.
Well, it's just like a rope, a burning rope in a way. Mm-hmm. And on the street you can smell it all the time because by every cigarette stall there's a slow-burning piece of rope and you buy a cigarette and you light it from that or you light a firecracker from it or something like that. So this is a very essential morning smell for the boy, and he suddenly smells all the ship. The ship has no smell, you know. It's kind of every major smell has been removed in a way. So he suddenly kind of smells something very real, and this leads him to this man Fonseca, who turns out to be a man from Sri Lanka going to England to become a teacher.
And he says he's leaving Sri Lanka, Ceylon forever.
Right, and then. When he says it to the boy, it's almost like a heartbreaking moment when the boy recognizes it's almost as if he says it to himself for the first time out loud. And so it's the first time in the book where the voice becomes the adult Michael, thinking about this man and how heroic in a way he was, you know, at that point in our life going to England.
Excuse me. I will be over this cough within a year. Let me try again. Is that what happened with you? You went to England.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the book ends. And then wound up in Canada. You didn't go back to Ceylon.
No, I didn't. I was, you know, I was one of those, as I said, one of those boys who went to England at 11 and went to school in England. And then when I finished school, I went to Canada. So... I never went back, really. I mean, I go back a lot now, but I hadn't, not as a teenager or a 20-year-old.
On a previous show, you told me that you begin each writing day as a blank slate and then produce a big, messy first draft that only begins to take shape in later drafts, where you figure out what themes you're interested in. Is that how you wrote this book?
Well, I think I did. I mean, I wrote this book a bit faster than normal. You know, that's a great line by a Hawaiian writer who says, you know, that rather than having an acknowledgements page, we should have an anti-acknowledgements page and list all the people who caused trouble to you during the writing of the book. And I was lucky I didn't have that person. So the book was written a bit faster. And the book felt a bit different because there was a very strict location in this book. You know, there was just one location, although the landscape kept changing around it. And so I felt the way the story fell onto the page was pretty much the way it ended up. I mean, there was a lot of editing and changing and sharpening of the scenes, but there weren't too many digressions and cul-de-sacs for me.
Well, the ship makes its way from the Indian Ocean through the Suez Canal and then into the Mediterranean,
mm-hmm.
and then on.
Yeah, that's only one way I can go.
Mm. Yeah, right, but that represents a wide range of experiences, at least on the shore.
Right, and so I mean, there's lots going on the ship and there's lots going on off the ship, so the boys land in Aden and they, you know, pick up a dog that causes trouble, and then in the Suez Canal, there's a kind of moment where you suddenly, which is almost like a little lens of going through childhood into a kind of adult voice, in a way. And you're suddenly, you've left the East. And so, I mean, there is, you ask if it was it's sort of a rite of passage, but it's not that pompously depicted, I suppose.
Well, there's the literal passage here.
Right.
Michael Ondaatje is the author of 5 previous novels, a memoir, a nonfiction book on film, and several books of poetry. The English Patient won the Booker Prize. Anil's Ghost won the Irish Times International Fiction Prize, the Giller Prize, and the Prix Medici. And now he's written The Cat's Table. It is published by Knopf. I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.